This is the Tan Talk Radio Network.
Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. And oh boy, do I have a great book for you today. It is so fantastic. It's called The Atlas Maneuver, and it is number 18 in the Cotton Malone series. And I am so happy to welcome back to Joy on Paper, Steve Berry. Hi, Steve.
Oh, good to be back.
Oh, wow. Oh, this is so exciting. Well, you know, I love all your books. I mean, what can I say? You are just so fantastic. I remember, you know, so much when I, here we are back at World War II. I love it. I actually remember where I was when I first read The Amber Room, because I love that book. I got such a kick out of that book. And of course that takes place, with all of the excitement that you had in that book. And then now in this book, we're back in World War II for a little while, and then we're back in really modern times. And you have really carried this off beautifully.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. I'm glad you like it.
Wow. Wow. Well, you know, Cotton Malone, you know, for me, a bookstore is a book. You know, is paradise. And having a character who owns a bookstore and is an antiquarian, my favorite kind of book store. Just tell us about this, because it's very clever. I love that you brought in this, both the history. I don't want to tell too much about the prologue, because that is a heck of a prologue.
Well, this book deals with two things that have fascinated me for a long time, and I never could figure out what I could do with them, and I finally figured out how to put them together. And the first one was, you just alluded to it in the prologue there, it deals with Yamashita's gold, which is an actual treasure from World War II that was, the Nazis plundered Europe, no question about it, but the Japanese were far more efficient and far better at it than the Nazis were, because they had been doing it three times as long. And they ended up with an enormous amount of gold and silver and precious metals and jewels and stuff that they wanted to get back to Japan. Unfortunately, they made it only as far as the Philippines, because we had by then blockaded off Japan. General Yamashita was told to bury the gold and it all in the ground, put it down there, make sure we can find it, because we're going to come back later and get it. And that's what he did. He put it in 175 underground vaults scattered all across the Philippines. He left markers to find it in the trees, the rocks, the ground. He had one map, and that was it. And the gold sat there until shortly after the war ended. American intelligence discovered that the gold had been put there and was able to locate some of the caches that were in the ground, not all, but just a few of them. But they got an enormous amount of gold out of the ground, and they kept it. They kept it secret, and they put it into a fund called the Black Eagle Trust, and they used it to finance covert intelligence operations for decades. Some say they're still doing it to this day using that money. We don't know for sure. All of that's classified. But we do know there was gold. We do know some of it was found. We do know the Americans kept it, and they told no one that they had it. So that always fascinated me. I said, that's really cool. What can I do with that? Well, another subject fascinated me, and that was Bitcoin. It's just one of those things that I knew absolutely nothing about. I just said, I don't have any comprehension of what this is. So I spent 6 months learning about it. I read books. I had some folks who taught me who do it for a living every day, and I learned about it. And then I began to see I could put these two together, because within the Bitcoin system, there is a flaw in the system. It exists. Bitcoiners don't like to talk about it very much, but it's there. But to make it work, you need a large amount of wealth. And so I had the gold, and then I put the two together, and I got the Atlas Maneuver, where Cotton Malone gets caught up in a war between the CIA and the world's oldest bank, and he's right in the middle of this thing. And so it all kind of came together very nicely.
Well, it certainly does. And I enjoyed so much this. First of all, I mean, when you did your research, this is really true. I mean, we've been kept in the seat, you know, we haven't been told about all of this by now. Nobody just released all the documents.
No, they're all classified. That's all classified still. Yeah, it's still classified. We have some information, and we have some aspects to show that the Black Eagle Trust existed. We know for a fact they found some of the gold. That we do know. We don't know how much. We don't know what they did with it. We don't know if any remains. That still remains classified. So that made it perfect for me to use in my in the story.
It gives you shivers when you think about it. It's really one of the things I think that many people will perhaps take away, at least from the prologue, realizing that something that Japan had extended themselves so far and had taken over so much territory. And, you know, today we're thinking about, can these kind of things happen? And it's still hard to believe what Japan was able to accomplish. So that's one aspect, I think, which people will find fascinating.
Yeah, and this is what I wanted to go into, because this is part of the true aspect of the novel. And then tying it into Bitcoin, of course, was my invention, but it came together nicely. And the Black Eagle Trust was administered over many banks across the globe. I just put all the money into one bank, is all I did, so that it was all in one location. And then Cotton gets caught up in the middle of all of this when he does a favor for his friend Derek Coker, and which supposed to be just a little simple little favor, take a few hours, turns into something much, much more.
Well, he has to get involved in a lot of things because we need him. We just love to get in and find out what he's going to do. But oh, this one, I think also the Bitcoin bit. No one understands it. I've tried to sort of understand it. Would you now, after you have done research, would you now invest in Bitcoin?
I have a Bitcoin or two. I do have a few, because I knew that would be asked of me when we did this. So I've already made that leap in there. I understand it perfectly fine now. I mean, it took me a while. Now, when the reader gets done reading my novel, they're going to understand it too, because I explained it pretty simply, and I showed you how it actually works, because it says Bitcoin in this novel is part of the plot. So you're going to see how it works and how it functions. You're going to see the flaw, and you're going to see how it can be exploited, and you're going to get a pretty good understanding of that. So that was one of the purposes of the novels. I do want to educate on Bitcoin.
Well, I think you've done that, because there have been quite a few books, you know, using Bitcoin, which you sort of skim past it. You don't understand it. But you're right. By the end of the book, you start to, yeah, wow. It really opens your mind.
That was part of it. That's exactly what I wanted to do, because, as I said, it's a subject that's very, it's fascinating. It's not going anywhere. It's going to be here. In fact, it's growing. It keeps getting bigger and bigger. And I wanted to, you know, it made for a good thriller. This, to me, I think, I did some look around. This may be the first thriller where Bitcoin is the plot of the novel. I don't know of any others. I couldn't find any anyway.
You're right. I think it's all encompassing here. The financial world, the hidden part that we don't know, that the public is still kept in the dark about. And this idea that all this stuff is going on around us and we're not aware of it. And I think it sort of opens our eyes to this fact.
Yeah, I think people, before you invest in something, you should get familiar with it and learn all about it so you can know all the ins and outs. And once you do that, then you can make an intelligent decision on doing it. Unfortunately, most people who buy Bitcoin don't really understand how it works and don't realize the good, the bad, the flaws, all those things that are in there. But you just got to do your homework. I spent about 6 months. It took me about 6 months to get a handle on it.
Well, isn't that part of the absolute fun of writing a book, that you get to do all this wonderful research?
I don't know if I would call it fun, because it's a lot of work. But it is a challenge, and it is intriguing, because along the way, as you do the research, you begin to develop the novel, and you find little nuggets here and there. And that is kind of fun, when you find a nugget that you go like, wow, I didn't know that. Boy, I didn't know that either. Oh, that fits here, that fits there. It's like putting a puzzle together. It's nice when all the pieces come together. It's frustrating along the way, but once you get all the pieces in place, you kind of say, that was pretty cool. And so that's the way it is to write a novel.
Well, you go down rabbit holes sometimes when you're doing research, and it's hard.
Yeah.
You can get lost. You can really get lost in it.
Yes, you can. And I make a point not to do that. I try to stay focused on it and stay right with it, because I only have 12 months to write this novel, so I don't have all day to start going off on tangents. But so I try to keep focused.
Well, and you have now. I can't remember. It's so funny. I've been talking to a lot of authors lately about the ones who feel that they've gotten their first rejection. I've been talking to a number of authors who recently got rejected, and I said, well, you're going to get rejected, but all the great authors have been rejected. So it just takes perseverance and hard work, and you certainly have put that in over the years.
Yeah, I mean, from the day I wrote my first word to the day I sold my first word was 12 years. I wrote 8 manuscripts. 5 went to New York houses. They were rejected 85 times. I made it the 86th time, 12 years after I started. So mine was a very long process to get published, and now here I am 21 years later and still going strong.
Going very strong, because, you know, Cotton, once you know about Cotton, once you met him, and tell us about Cotton for the readers and the listeners who don't know about him, because when you came out with him, I thought it was so clever, and as I said, partly because of his love of books and my love of books, it was like a perfect fit.
Yeah, I created him in 2006 in the Templar Legacy. That was the very first book with Cotton Malone, and he's a retired Justice Department agent who lives in Copenhagen and owns an old bookshop, and kind of wants to be left alone, but gets drawn back in all the time. He gets kind of drawn back into his former world, and he's had 18 adventures. This is the 18th one we're doing now, and the reader should not be put off by that, because you do not have to read the other 17 to understand 18. You can pick the series up anywhere you want. I write them that way on purpose, so there's no requirement you have to read them all, or even read them in order. But he's an interesting guy. He's not a Daniel Craig kind of James Bond guy. He's more like a George Clooney kind of guy, kind of a guy next door that's kind of unassuming, that you would never think had these abilities, but he can rise up and do extraordinary things when he needs to, and he's very smart, and he's caught on. People like him because I think because of that guy next door quality of him. He also has an ex-wife, a son. He has problems like we all have. He has a girlfriend who he has trouble with. He's not the best dealing with relationships. Emotions are difficult for him, but he's changed over the years. He's not the same character from the Templar Legacy. He's evolved. In every novel, I try to explore at least one aspect of his personality that I've never explored before, and in this book, we deal with regret. He comes face to face with something from his past that he thought he would never see or deal with again. A failure, a mistake that he made many years ago that he preferred not to be reminded of, but here it is, right here in front of him, and he's got to deal with it, and the emotion of regret comes into play, and there's a surprise at the end of the novel that should catch the reader totally off guard, that sets some things up for what's going to happen over the next 2 to 3 books.
Which, I know that you've probably finished 19 by now.
I actually have. 2025 novel is done. So yes, you stay a year ahead of the book business.
Yeah, you have to. And in this book, of course, we have Cassiopeia and we have Stephanie and some of the other wonderful characters that you've developed. Tell us about when you go about putting these characters together. How did you do that? How did you bring them out?
Well, I needed supporting players, and I knew that. Templar Legacy, when you meet Cotton, you really meet Cotton as he interacts with Stephanie Nell, who's his former boss, who he worked for at the Magellan Billet in the Justice Department. So you learn about both of those characters there. And Stephanie's come in and out of the series. She's in and out of books. She's in most of the books. She's certainly mentioned in all of the books. And we've dealt with her, and there's been development of her character over the years. And then Cassiopeia Vitt was a character I created in Templar Legacy. She was kind of a secondary player. And then I got the concept of, well, let's make her more. And so she's evolved, and her and Cotton didn't really like each other at first. They didn't get along at all. In fact, she shot at him the first time they ever met. She's shooting at him. And so after a while, though, they began to get close to one another, and now they are very close, and they've recognized they each need each other, and there's a relationship there. And so the interaction with her and Cotton are very good. In this book, they're there together, but they're on different stages. They eventually come together at the end of the book. Luke Daniels is another character who comes in and out of the books. He's a younger agent who can do things Cotton wouldn't do. He's impatient. He's impetuous. He can be hot-headed. He can make mistakes that Cotton wouldn't make. And he's been in a bunch of books, and he has his own series, too. We did one last year. Grant Blackwood and I did one called The Ninth Man with Luke, and we're doing another one coming June 11th this year called Red Star Falling, and there'll be a third one coming down the road. So Luke's kind of got his own little series, which is fun, and I've enjoyed developing him. So those are the cast of characters there. Now, in each book, I have a different set of bad guys, and that's what makes each book different, because there's a different bad guy, different motivations, different things that are there.
Yeah, I enjoyed talking to Grant about it. You know, when you are the way you write, and you write so powerfully, I love, there's a lot of action in this one. And of course, a lot of the action centers around both, of the main characters. And so that makes it really exciting. Now, you've been writing for a long time, and I know that you started the, what was it, which organization did you start?
I was involved in helping create International Thriller Writers.
International Thriller Writers, which mm-hmm. has quite a few members. So this is a genre that people love. I think one of the things, when you take us into these actions and when you combine it, I think it's really great when you put in the history, and we learned so much about the world, because you've taken us in these books, you've taken us to so many locations, and it's always so exciting to discover something new, and you've done that.
Well, each book does that. Each book I go to different locales, and I do that on purpose, because I want the locales to become almost like characters in the story. The locales are not just backdrops. They're important to the plot. They fit into the plot, and I try to make sure that I do different ones in every book. And that's part of the niche I've carved for myself, that people enjoy seeing these new locales. In this book, we go to Luxembourg, we go to Switzerland, and then we go to the Atlas Mountains of Morocco, which are quite remarkable down there, where about a third of the novel takes place down there, which I visited, and I was there. So that's, you know, part of it. You know, to give kind of a little bit of a travel log and also a little bit of history lesson, and hopefully get you excited that you might want to go see those places.
Well, that's what you do. You make us you take us to these locations, and we really, I remember during the pandemic, reading some of your books, and we were able to travel with you, in our minds. And now you're right. You do want to sort of get up and go and see some of these locations.
Mm-hmm. That's what we hope for.
Well, you certainly. So how did you find Morocco? Was it fun?
Oh, I enjoyed it. It was very pretty. But down in the Atlas Mountains, Richard Branson, who owns Virgin, has bought an old estate down there and converted it into a hotel. It's really quite magnificent down there in the mountains and well worth a visit. It's just very pretty up there. It's a kind of barren, wild, isolated place down in Morocco. And I thought, well, this would be a perfect place to bring a novel to a conclusion. So that's what we did.
Well, one the nice thing about traveling a lot, you get to take it off your IRS. It's a deductible traveling because you certainly are doing the research.
Well, that's the only reason we went, was to do the research to put the book together. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, when I noticed at the beginning of your book, I thought it was very sweet that you dedicated it to an editor. They are really unsung heroes of the publishing world. They don't often get recognized. And I thought that was so sweet of you to do that, because when I've been talking, as I said, I've talked to these writers who have been rejected. And one of the things I've said to them, are you sure that your book was ready to be sent out? Did you go through an editor? And some of them had not. They had gone to, you know, writers groups and things like that, but they hadn't actually used a real professional editor. But a great editor is worth their weight in gold.
Oh, no question about it. And Wes was great. He left Grand Central during the process of this book. This was the last book he and I worked on, and he was really great. He was a great editor, and I'm sorry to see him go. So I gave him a shout out and gave him a book dedicated to him. He earned it. He's a great guy, and he went on to do some other things in other places.
Well, that's wonderful. I think that editors need that kind of recognition sometimes, just to make them, you know, they deserve it. They work hard, and it's a difficult thing, you know, with somebody, for example, when they're working with somebody as famous as you. Other, you know, writers who are just starting off think that editors could be, you know, so critical that you'd get depressed. But you have to be able to take the criticism if they criticize you. I don't know how.
I want honest opinions. I was taught in a writer's group, so I was taught with criticism, and I don't mind criticism. I also learned how to self-edit, and that's one thing writers today do not really work on very well, is the art of self-editing. So I'm harder on me than any editor would ever be. And so by the time the manuscript gets to Wes or Lissa, who's my new editor, we've got it pretty clean. It's really clean. And then they go through it, and they'll notice some things that I might have missed, and I welcome that. I welcome it very much so. But I make sure when I give them a manuscript, it is as clean and as good as I can possibly do it. So, you know, their job is not as difficult, because they don't have to worry about cleaning up the manuscript. They just have to worry about polishing it up a little bit. And that's really what we need. We need polish on it.
When you're self-editing, do you read your manuscript out loud?
Not out loud, but I do 50 to 60 reads on a manuscript. 50 to 60 reads on a manuscript, yeah.
And do you print it out to read it too?
I used to. I don't anymore. I do it all on the screen now. I used to go back and forth, but no one uses hard copies anymore, and I just got out of the habit of doing it, so now I do it completely on the screen.
Well, what a great loss, actually, when you think about it in the future for all the PhD students who won't have manuscripts to work from.
Yeah, they don't. Publishing houses don't use any physical manuscripts anymore. That's all gone. In fact, the copy editing is also done electronically now, too. And that took that was a little bit of a challenge for me to figure out. I have to say that was a little harder for me, but I've gotten used to it now. I've done 4 or 5 now, and I think I can. I think I've converted over now. I can make it work.
Well, have you ever done research or gone to a particular author that you've admired and looked at their manuscripts, their original manuscripts?
No, I've never been privy to be able to see those, unfortunately. No, their original manuscripts sometimes bear little relation to what's finished. You know, there's a lot of changes that go through it between those there. There's a lot of people reading it. There's proofreaders reading it. There's a lot of folks involved in it. So I keep my original file that I sent in after we get it finished, and that's the file that goes to copy edit. But then the novel begins. The copy edit makes changes and changes it because I don't ever keep any of those past that point. No.
Well, I know you, of course, in the old days, like more than 10 years ago. Because, you know, nowadays things move so quickly. We went from computers to this to this to this, and now, as you said, you're doing copy editing online. But one of my guests was Margaret George, and she wrote the autobiography of Henry VIII, and she wrote it by hand. You know,
wow,
900 pages of it. So those days are gone.
Pretty much gone. Yes.
So when you're working, one of the things. You get now, after the pandemic, are you going out back and doing events, with the Thriller Writers Organization or VoucherCon or any of those? Are you doing any of those events?
No, I don't do this. I went on tour. I was on tour for a week, and we went all around the country. That was a couple of weeks ago. And I've been doing radio interviews and interviews like this to get the word out. I do a few events a year. I don't do near the events I used to do. I don't probably do one or two events a year now, when I used to do 25 or 30 a year. So I do, I've scaled that back quite a bit.
So what's the most interesting fan you've ever met along the way? Have you had any
interesting fan? Yeah, that's a hard one. I don't know. I mean, that's a good question. I mean, the fans that are to me the most special are the ones who come up and say, I was in the hospital for 2 months and I was laid up and I couldn't go anywhere and I was in pain and I read your books while I was there and it helped me get through that. Those are very gratifying to hear those kinds of things. Or the soldier who says, I had your books when I was deployed to Afghanistan and I had your books and I read them while I was over there, and it helped me get through that. Those are really special and very gratifying, and those I like to hear. That's when you say, well, that's pretty cool that this story that I made up and created, they brought joy to somebody like that. That's very special.
Oh, that's nice. Yes, it's true. And for me, it's also been in my life in difficult times, and when I've been, in strange places, just to have a book is so important. And that's why that's really why I started this program. It's going to be the 9th anniversary of Joy on Paper in March. When I started this, I had no idea that I would last this long. But why I enjoy it so much is I've had this opportunity to bring your books like yours to people who perhaps hadn't thought about reading, you or any book at all. And so it's so exciting when somebody will come to me and say, I started reading because you made the book and the author sound so interesting. I wanted to know more. And that's why I'm so grateful to you and, just for coming on the program, because it makes a difference. If we can excite people about books, and the more they read, I think they will find that joy that I'm talking about on paper.
Well, that's great. You've experienced the same thing that I did. You know what that feels like. It is pretty amazing.
Now, because in America right now, we just don't have enough readers. We need to encourage reading, and so that's why I am really doing this program, and to try to encourage readers, try to encourage people to get involved in libraries if they're interested in writing. That they always say there's a book in everyone, and people, if they want to write, they should write and just find that joy on paper. And of course, not get upset if you're rejected. As you were rejected.
Well, you learn from it. You learn from it and keep going forward and keep moving forward. I mean, I tell people all the time, I may not know anything about writing, but I'm a world-class expert on rejection. I understand it very well. And you have to learn to embrace it and learn from it and move forward with it. And for me, it was 12 years, and it wasn't pleasant. There was nothing fun about it, I can tell you now. It was terrible, but in the end, Lady Luck one day said, well, I beat you up for 12 years, and today I'm going to give you a break. Today's your day. And, I got it, in 2002 when they bought the Amber Room and I got published. So I would tell writers just to hang in there. Of course, in my day, we didn't have independent publishing. We didn't have Kindle Unlimited. We didn't have Amazon, really. Amazon had just started then as very, very small. It was a very different world then.
When you were finally accepted for Amber Room, which, I mean, it's an amazing book. It is so wonderful. What was that like for you? I mean, do you remember the day?
I remember it very well. Yeah, I was in Copenhagen and just going over for fun, really. And came back to the hotel and there was a fax. It was the days when we had fax machines. There were no smartphones and nothing like that. And there was a fax waiting for me that my agent said that we had resubmitted the Amber Room a few weeks earlier. The Amber Room was submitted in 1994, 95, was rejected by all 17 publishers at the time. So it sat in a drawer for 6 years, for 5 years. And no, 7 years, I'm sorry, 7 years sat in a drawer. And I convinced my agent to resubmit it in 2002, and Mark Tavani at Random House bought it because Random House had bought Da Vinci Code and they wanted books to go with Da Vinci. They weren't sure what was going to happen with Da Vinci. This is a year before it's published now. But they knew they had something kind of different, something special. It was action, history, secrets, conspiracies, and that's exactly what my book was. So I got bought. And I remember sitting on the bed and looking at the facts and kind of going, wow, I did it. I actually did it. I mean, 12 years after we started, there it is, right there in front of you. And you have this moment of great joy, and then you also have this moment of, man, I'm tired. Boy, that was a long journey, it was pretty neat. So they bought two books, and that's what got me started. And Dan gave me a wonderful blurb for the Amber Room, called it My Kind of Thriller. And it sold very well, and all the books sold well, and then eventually the fourth book came, Templar Legacy, and that's the book that changed everything for me. That was my breakout book. It kicked me up.
And do you remember, of course, in those days you got a check, a real check.
You didn't get direct deposits or things. They sent checks to your agent, and your agent sent checks to you. That's the way it worked.
Yeah, that's exciting. That's wonderful. Well, I'm trying to think of all those people who rejected it, because I mean, I couldn't imagine rejecting it unless you didn't rewrite it over and over.
The world changed. That's what
happened. The world changed. Wow.
Yeah. Because in 1990, the Soviet Union collapsed, the Cold War ended, the Berlin Wall came down, and the spy novel died. That it just died. And by the mid-90s, the genre was pretty dead. And by 2000, it was cold and dead in the ground. And if you were John Le Carré, or you were Ludlum or Cussler, you were fine because you had an audience. But if you were Steve Berry trying to break in, nobody was buying those books. Then Da Vinci comes along and reinvents the spy novel, and it's now action, history, secrets, conspiracies, becomes an international suspense thriller. And he reignited the genre in a new way, and I just happened to be, after 12 years, at the right place at the right time with the right story. And so it wasn't that they were critical of anything, it just was the time wasn't right for it. The world changed at the precise moment when I was ready, and it It was just one of those, like I said, Lady Luck said, today's your day.
Well, and Lady Luck gave us a big gift because we got all of these books of yours. And the new one, of course, the Atlas Maneuver, is the Cotton Malone number 18, which 18 is a really lucky number. And this is a book that people will, I tell you, all of my listeners, you will enjoy this book for on so many levels, the historical, the thriller, the financial, because it really, Steve has really gone into this subject deeply and has come out with the ability to tell us about Bitcoin, and we will learn a lot.
That's the whole idea. That's what I'm hoping for. Hopefully they'll get a good feel for it. They're going to learn some things about Yamashita's gold. They're going to learn quite a few things. It's an interesting novel. I enjoyed writing it.
Well, you've done a brilliant job with it. And I think, as the founder of the International Thriller Writers, you've lived up to the founding legacy of really giving us a big thriller. It's lots of fun. It's a really fun read. And when I think about it, I was thinking about it, when I first interviewed you, I of course remembered that, about the Amber Room. I know it was, released so many years ago, but I actually had read it not long after. I mean, I read it the first time when it came out, because I would read anything about the Romanovs. I do a lot of Russian history and Napoleonic history, so I'm always interested in Russia. And I read it when it came out, when it first came out, and then I had read it again, like maybe 10 years later. That's before I started the program. So I was reading it because it holds up. I mean, it is a really solid thriller. And so this is the wonderful thing about the being on the internet, that people can go back and read all of these books. As you said, all of the Cotton Malone are standalones. You can pick sort of the location where you're interested in going and sort of travel with you to these locations. So they don't have to be read in any order. They always make sense. But you can even go further back, and I really would encourage my listeners to go back and read. I think the Amber Room is, I remember the excitement I had when I read that book.
A lot of people say that's their favorite book of mine. And his first novel, with the first novel, I wish I could get my pen to it. I could take 3,000-5,000 words out of it, make it a little shorter, a little tighter. But, I'm proud of it. It's a good story, and all the books are, I try to make sure that they stay relevant and that they're not overly timely. And readers who have never, listeners of yours who have never read me before, can certainly, check them out at my website, steveberry.org. All the books are there, and you can find what period of history interests you. All the books deal with something different from history. And find what you might find interesting, and if you like it, you can check out some more.
Yeah, exactly. This is wonderful, and it is a good, really good website for getting an all-encompassing view of Steve Berry's work. And mm-hmm. I would encourage everyone to go there, and of course, to keep we will keep waiting for the next release. And it's always exciting to talk to you, Steve. I want to thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today. It means a great deal to me, because, as I said, I'm going into the 9th anniversary of Joy on Paper, and having the ability to talk to, someone like you, someone who's really at the forefront of a genre, really a leader in the field. It's a thrill for me to talk to a thriller writer.
Well, thank you for having me on. I appreciate it. I hope everybody will go out and give the Atlas Maneuver a try.
I'm going to keep telling them about it. So thank you again, Steve.
All right,
thank you so much.
All right.
Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
Okay. Wow. What a wonderful guy. His books are so good. I get so excited when I read his books, because I love cotton. You know, for me, anybody, for a little while, I had a very small book nook. It was a small bookstore. I never was able to get very big because it's a bookstore is a lot of work, a lot of work. You have to, as we know now after the pandemic, so many of them closed down. So you have to admire, if you have a bookstore, a real bookstore in your area, an independent bookstore, please, in the Clearwater area, we have Haslam's bookstore, which has been around for many decades. But wherever you are, if there is a bookstore in your area, please go there and just thank them for staying open and for the work that they do. Because one of the things and why it's so important to have these bookstores is it gives a place for the authors to come and do some book tours and travel and meet people. And that's a lot of fun. So we're going to go and we're going to do a promo for Jim Lamb and some commercials. And then I'll be back to talk to you about some upcoming shows.
Looking for inspiration? Looking for something that will intrigue you? Then this book is for you. Jim Lamb's poems start out as caterpillars, creepy, crawly, and raw. Then a miracle happens as they transform into colorful, bright, and conspicuous works of art. You can find Jim's new book of poetry, Hurting Butterflies, at Amazon.com. It's the perfect gift for the book lover in your life, even if it's you. Hurting Butterflies, the perfect holiday gift, available on Amazon. Get Hurting Butterflies.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more recording careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida, can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at LarsonPatentLaw.com.
Have you ever faced disaster? The Red Cross is always there for you. The Red Cross responds to a call for help every 8 seconds. They have never turned anyone down. Now they need your financial support so that they can be ready to help you when the need arises. Donate online at redcross.org. Thank you.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
And I am back, and I have a few minutes, and I want to talk about some things that are happening. And before I leave today, I'm going to play Boxcar by Haley Woolbright. It's so funny. She was on the program a few weeks ago, and over the years since she first appeared, and that was a long time ago, before the pandemic, I started playing this song of hers, Boxcar, and it just got in my head. And I have been, for years, I have been thinking about this song, and every time I hear it, I don't know, I see it in my head. I see this boxcar, and I see it as part of an opening of a film. Somehow, I'm trying to, if I could do a film, I almost could do a film based on that it's a simple song. And the music world is difficult to understand because this is a catchy song. And it's a song that when you hear it, it's like you're welcoming it back. Like, wow, yeah, I like that song. And I tell you, it It's not an age thing. I mean, I like some of the modern music. I just, you know, new releases, they're exciting, but they just don't quite catch you sometimes that you want to see. When you have a song that you want to see, I would love to visualize it. I would like to see it. They used to have that, what was that show? The one where they had all the videos, MTV, and I don't watch much television nowadays, but I would just love to, I wish somebody would pick this up for a film, because I want to do it myself. So if I win the lottery, I'm going to do a film, and it's going to be the funniest thing. I'm going to do it based on the story that I see in my head when I play Boxcar. I don't know why. It's just something great. And Haley, of course, is just a wonderful, wonderful young songwriter. And I was so happy that she both has premiered some songs here on Joy on Paper, because I really admire her work. And you never know, as you just heard Steve Barrett, when you think about it, that he was rejected, you know, I mean, it's hard. When I think about it, I remember when I first read, as I said to him, when I first read that book, I remember exactly where I was. I remember the location where I was sitting when I read that book, and I couldn't put it down. It's called The Amber Room, and it is just such a well-written book. So when you think about that, it was rejected over and over. I mean, 85 rejections. Wow. It really shows that you have to be persistent. 85 rejections, 12 years. And then he comes out, and that was a bestseller. And the beautiful thing about it is it is as exciting today to read that book as it was when it came out. That just shows you a writer who has learned his craft. And it took him some time. I hope that all of you people who I encourage to start writing your books, if you haven't written your books, well, I don't want you to have to go through 12 years. I also, last week, I spoke to Jennifer Lang about a wonderful new sort of style of writing. And it's called the micro memoir. And it's a smaller version of a memoir. So for people who aren't sure that they can write, you know, a big memoir, well, perhaps you don't have to. You can write these mini memoirs. They're really interesting. It's a new style, a new way to write. And I will be having a few more of the people who are writing these memoirs on the program to explain how they're doing it, why they're doing it, and perhaps that will inspire you, because there is truly a book in everybody. It might not be a bestseller, but it's a book that you could be proud of if you write and you want to have it out there for your family, for your friends, for posterity. Because some of my favorite books, I have next to me a book that was written in 1894. It's a little book, a very slim book. Sort of a micro memoir, but it's only about a specific trip that somebody took. And they wrote it. It was published. It was like 100 pages. That book is more precious to me than anything. I have read that book over and over and over. And I am working with Andrea Hiotis, who is... she's a wonderful, wonderful artist and a fan of Joy on Paper. And we are going to put this book together with some of her artwork. And I will be announcing that in the future. That's one of the exciting projects I'm working on. I'm working on a lot of projects. But anyway, I'm going to go off now in a minute with Haley Woolbright's Boxcar. But first, I want to also say a special thank you to Carol J. Perry for her support of Joy on Paper, and to tell you that, oh, she's working, and she's got a lot of books coming out. She's got two books coming out this year, and we will have her on to talk about those books, and just, there's so many exciting things. But I want to remind you that Bill Larson is coming to talk about AI and how it impacts you as a writer, and for readers, what you should be looking for when you are picking up a book. And so you don't want to read an AI book. You don't want to read an AI. That's why I like to bring you authors, so you can get to meet the authors and know them and get to love them as I do, and just read more. There's so many things going on in the world, and you think, well, I can't take one more thing. Well, perhaps all you need to do is sit back, relax, and of course, it's still cold in some places, but for many people in the South, it's just beautiful weather. Get out there with a book and start reading and have fun. And as I discovered with Steve's recent book, it is just so wonderful to be able to travel around the world with an author. They give us this grand tour, and it's right there at your fingertips. All you have to do is pick up a book and read and enjoy yourself. And that's what I want for all of you, to find that joy on paper. So we're going to play Boxcar, and I'm going to be out of here. And I want to thank everybody for a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful week. I've had a great time, and a special thanks to Bria Burton for guest hosting on Tuesday, her special sci-fi hour, and she's going to be back on March 26th. Okay, we're headed down on a boxcar.
Been stowed away on this boxcar for quite some time.